What's up, everybody? Welcome to the ProVise Project. It's your boy, Temprovise. I just want to give a massive shout out to everybody that's listening. Thank you for your support. You can support me over at patreon.com/theProVise Project. But on this episode, we have P Money. If you're unfamiliar with P Money's work, look him up. He has done some amazing, both like, you know, in the spotlight and out of the spotlight work. I was really, really thankful that he gave up some time. We talk around a lot of things in terms of music and things like that. So I've had to cut this up into two parts. So the other part will be out tomorrow. But this part is really around his upbringing in music and how we got into everything. Hope you enjoy it. And yeah, like I said, follow, leave a review, all that good stuff. And we'll catch you on the next episode tomorrow. All right, guys. Peace. Hey, P Money, brother. Can you hear me?
Hey, yeah. What's up?
What's up, bro? Hey, thank you so much for your time tonight, my bro.
Oh, pleasure. Pleasure.
Did you have anything planned? You didn't break your plans, did you?
No. Okay. Not much planned this evening, Monday.
Bro, with level one today, man, does that open up? Are you still doing live gigs and stuff?
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's a big part of how I make a living. So huge news to know that we've got the all clear for the large gatherings.
Mean, yeah, bro. Oh, anyway, sorry, mate. Just getting all my shit together.
All good.
You know, I got a lot of things. Bro, we got a question in the chat for everybody. I want to see everybody's favorite Dirty Records artist. All right, we got David Dallas, we got PNC, we got Scribe, and it was Vince Hart on Dirty.
Yeah. For a short period of time, we had Vince with us as well.
All right, is there anyone I'm missing?
We had a secret. If anyone can name the secret artist that was with us for one album release, then you get a special prize. There was a guy who went by the name Unique, and he does like one song on my first album. And we actually did an album deal with him, like just to put out his first thing. And then we basically dropped. It's not funny. We let go of him from our roster like the same week we put the album out, which is terrible timing. It didn't work out.
Where was he from?
He was from, I want to say, Te Aroha. Yeah, Te Aroha.
Oh, man. Some talent coming out West, eh? Out West Auckland?
Yeah. Especially definitely. Lately. Always.
Man. Oh, man. Anyway, bro, let's get straight into it, bro. Edmund Hillary, brother. We're going all the way back to Edmund Hillary, my G. Bro, like, first time hearing Peter Piper pick Peppers. Run DMC, bro. Explain that feeling, my bro, when you heard that the first time. You got that cassette tape. Was it on cassette or was it on vinyl?
Bro, the first time I heard that song, I didn't even hear the song. I heard like other kids in my class rapping it. That's how I heard like that Run DMC song, Peter Piper, was two other friends in my class rapping it back and forth like they were a little Run DMC. We must have been, I don't even know, man, 8, 9 years old. We're kids, like little kids. And I was like, oh, that's cool. That's all, like, as my memory serves me now, I was kind of like, that's cool, what is it? And then maybe within a week or so, someone has a cassette tape with, like, Vivid written on there, like, Run DMC, and I get to take that home. Maybe I was older, maybe I was, like, 10. I was definitely old enough to, like, want to get a tape and listen to it. But we were small. So, yeah.
Yo. See, I told you on that Nardwuar shit, brother.
See, bro, that was a true story. How do you know what was happening and in 1980?
You're Pee Money. We have to know this. Nah, man. But like Edmund Hillary, bro, that's good, man. That's there's a lot of history at Edmund Hillary. I don't like in terms of there's a lot of people that came out of Edmund Hillary from Papakura and then went off to. So did you go straight to where'd you go? Intermediate? Like was that?
Yeah, so all of these schools are right next to each other. You have Edmund Hillary Primary, then you have Papakura Intermediate, and then you have Papakura High School. And I lived on Laurie Ave, which is the road that borders both of those schools, or almost all three of those schools. There's like a dairy and I think a liquor store now, but there wasn't when I was growing up, like on the corner. So if anyone knows that neighborhood, it's like Settlement Road, Laurie Ave. I was right there. And that was the beginnings of it all, man. Went to all of those schools and yeah, that's where I was at.
That train station was legendary. There was a lot of shit that went down at that train station.
Yep.
Bro, I remember drinking it up. Everybody, I remember like people from my hood, some from Rewa or JC, would go out there just to drink up with the bros like during school time.
Oh,
you know. Wow. And then because there was no fences back then, people would just walk out. Yeah. They didn't care. Even Papakura's got some history, bro. You, oh, Phil's from, did Phil go to Papakura High?
I'm not certain. He may have. I don't want to say he didn't, but obviously we're 10 years apart, so I wouldn't have been there at the same time as him. But yeah, he's definitely Kura though, Kura High, for
sure. Yeah, it's Kura, and yeah, Kura's grown a lot lately. Like I've been, like I got to go through there to go to work, and I'm like, far out, man. It's still cool. Like, you know, it's not one of those depressing ones, those ugh like ones, but it's like, oh shit, like they've got a lot of things going on. It's cool to know that you came from there, bro. Like, to be honest.
Yeah, man. It's just where I grew up, you know, it's where my parents chose to reside. My dad was always working in the area. He had a men's clothing store, which is something that's kind of gone out of style. You don't really have an independent, like, owner-operator men's clothing shop, but that was, my dad started that business when I was probably 14. Prior to that, he worked for another guy who had a similar business. So I was always in the main street of Papakura, Great South Road, because I'd just go see my dad at work, and then my dad, like, started a shop, so I'd help him at the shop. So just all around that main street, like, my whole childhood. Yeah, you just leave school, you walk uptown, you go to the 2Js and you play Street Fighter, or you watch other people play Street Fighter because you don't have any coins. And then you go home, or in my case, go to my dad's work and then I go home with him.
But they still have like hardcore skate, you know, across the road from old Roadies, old the Roadhouse.
Yes, I know it well.
That's why I brought it up, bro. Actually, we've got some camera footage on.
camera footage of empty gigs me playing in the hometown and only a few people come. But some of the nights were big, but a lot of them were quiet.
On Wednesdays, bro, when they have all you can eat ribs, brother, I'm telling you, that's the day you got to go.
Okay, see, now I've been getting it wrong. I've been going DJing on a Saturday. I haven't played there in years, mind you.
It's a long time ago. It's the amalgamation of all you can eat ribs and then bowl days on Wednesday as well. Oh. So it's like, you know, you get in there, brother, and it's good. But right across the road from there, Street Fighter, there's a few Street Fighter machines, and that's where I used to go, because you could get across that car park easy from the train station, go straight in, play some Streety, and come back. Have a piss up with your mates at the train station, and then you're good, you know. And then somebody does some dumb shit, and then you're like, "Fuck!"
Invariably, someone does something dumb, and if depending on your age, you're probably, you know, a co-defendant on that situation.
So, bro, how'd you get into DJing then? Like, so you know, out in Kura, there wasn't a lot of rock shops out those ways, but like, especially in the 80s, like, how did you get started?
Well, it was more the 90s for me, like being a teenager and just loving, there's other, you know, older kids or whatever, we'd share in rap music. It was all on cassette. It was on tape. So that was the main format. We were listening on cassette tapes and just like, always just fiending for the latest albums, and I was always excited by there would be a lot of DJ elements on these songs, like hip hop in the from about 80 when I was tuning in from about 88 to 94-5, there was so much scratching in the songs. Like, DJs were main parts of songs and groups, so the chorus wouldn't even be a sung hook, it would be a DJ cutting up some words or some sound effects. So that's what got me. And it was DJs like Terminator X from Public Enemy, of course, Jam Master J, Run DMC, and Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. Like, Jeff's still one of my favorite DJs. So these guys were all doing their cuts and scratches as the main part of every song. And I thought, well, that's an awesome way. Like, I wanted to be involved in music, but I was too shy to be a rapper and be up front. And I didn't think I had any stories to tell. Mm. So I was like, how can I be involved? And it just made sense to be the DJ and play the beats and let other people rap and, you know, give everyone else the space to rap, and I'll just be in the background because that looks cool and it suited like the shy kid that wanted to do music. So that was really my motivation. It wasn't so much like I saw other people doing it in my neighborhood or in the city, because I was pretty much at home and then at school and uptown for like an hour or two and then back home. So I wasn't the kid going into the city and sneaking into clubs or any of that. I was at home. And I got hold of like just the record player. Like, man, this is showing age, but people of this generation might know, we used to have the your music source at home was like a MIDI system. So the bottom was cassettes, then the middle was a tape, radio tuner, and then the top would have a record player on top. I used that I started learning on that. Wow. And just like scratching the record back and forth and breaking needles and just trying to make it happen, man. Anyways, that's the origins. That's how we start.
I got to give you props, okay? Because I heard through someone that you hustled a turntable by trading in a black and white CV. Is this true, bro?
Yes, you are, Nardwa.
I do my research, brother. I'm just saying that.
This is crazy. I considered myself a pretty lucky kid to have this old-ass, tiny black and white TV that was in my bedroom. I could watch my own TV as a kid, you know, like 13. But the opportunity arose. I saw someone with a proper turntable, a standalone, not a 1200, not an expensive one, but a turntable that wasn't part of this whole stereo. Mm. I was like, I need one of those. And so I offered this lady who was a friend of our family, I was like, can I have that? And she's like, well, yeah, but maybe not. Like, you have to buy it. And I said, oh, can I swap you my TV? And she wanted to give it to her kids. So she's like, yeah, we don't use records. You have the turntable. We'll take the TV. And that was the best trade of my life.
Thank you, bro. That's hustle. Was mom and dad all good with that? Or they were like, what the fuck, man?
No, yeah. I mean, a little bit, like probably my dad. But I'm not sure if that television was very valuable. It was pretty old even at that time, that technology. Yeah. So it was cool, man. That's how I got my own proper turntable. Then I could set that up in my room and start trying to copy the scratches that I heard on everybody's songs and trying to mimic like what I'd hear in mixtapes. But I only had one turntable.
Yo.
And then, so it wasn't like mixing. It was just scratch. That's it.
And straight up hustle at the garage sale to get that mixer, right?
The mixer came along probably a year later.
Was the other turntable from the garage sales?
The mixer came along a year later, and then a second turntable around the same time, and that was garage sales for sure.
Used to be the shit, yo.
Bro, I swear, it's like $20 maybe, and I picked up this turntable, and I picked up a set of speakers, big like wooden box looking things with big woofers, and it was sick. It was perfect. So by that time, maybe I'm like 16, and I've got this most rugged setup, but that's all I needed, man. I was getting busy.
But did you get into any house parties, bruv? I bet once.
Nah. See, I was really, I guess, left out of social circles or just not a very social kid. I was super like nerdy about music and hip hop and like graffiti. So I'd be practicing tagging in my black books and other places and just doing music or trying to learn how to do like musical stuff. So I wasn't going out. I didn't go out to parties until I started getting booked as like a proper DJ.
Because, bro,
which is pretty weird, right?
For me, man, like DJing's always, like whenever I think about DJing back in those days, I always remember Martin Lawrence on House Party.
Yep.
And like how he stuffed all that stuff in that little ass car. And then he was like, yo, I got to come too. They're like, man, we'll pick you up later. I was like, fuck, man. That always rings true to me, bro. Like,
and that's true for a lot of DJs that, you know, that was kind of, that was a comedy version of what would really happen, you know, load up. But my story was a little bit different. It was quite isolated.
Let's go back, bro, a little bit. Like, how did BFM, like True School, like affect you as a teenager, bro?
Wow. Immense, huge impact on my awareness of music, like knowledge of music, my knowledge of DJing, hip hop culture. And this was from listening to like DLT, Severe, of course, and Mark James, aka the Rhythm Slave, he was up there, and bass, and those four guys had this radio show called the True School Hip Hop Show, and I would listen to it religiously every week for 2 hours Thursday nights, and I would record that on a cassette and listen to it all through the week, and then the next week record the next show, and just, man, that was like the best. That was the best, man.
You ever get pissed off at these kids these days that like moan that they don't have opportunity when they have YouTube and Google? I know this is old man shit right now.
Who's complaining though? Like, are people in your life complaining about?
I don't know.
Like, young people?
All these young ones.
all these imaginary people.
All these complaints. Young bloods. You know, they're always out here. Bloody hell. Fucking hell. Fucking complaining about every fucking thing. But you know what I mean? Like, sometimes you're like, man, you guys have got so much at your fingertips. It is so crazy how you guys aren't better than what you actually are. How you guys
I'll counter that because... Okay. For those individuals who are as obsessed with something creative as I was when I was a youth, I think they do get better and they get better quicker. And because of the access to knowledge for those really driven people. So look at DJ K Swiss. You've heard of him?
Yep.
DJ K Swiss. How old is this kid now? Maybe 15 tops, 16? He's been DJing since he was 10. Like, he was DJing since he's 10 years old. He's a three-time world DJ champion.
That's crazy.
Age of barely 16.
Yeah.
So that's the perfect example. I think that's a kid of this generation with all the resources, with all the YouTube, with access to everything. And it doesn't hurt, his old man was a DJ, so they already had the equipment in the house. And he could just go so deep and learn so much. He's infinitely more skillful and technical than I think I may ever be. Oh, and that's at that age. So I really, really hold him in a high regard. But that's my answer to that. I think, yeah, there's a lot of kids that get distracted with all the technology and just end up doing things that are not very productive and maybe wasting a lot of valuable time as a youth. Yeah. But then there's those exceptions that are just using it to accelerate their learning and become brilliant at stuff. So I tend to focus on the positive cases rather than the less productive ones. But, you
way,
know.
To, way to go, Pete, making me look like an asshole on my own show.
Not at all, man. That's my viewpoint. That's my view on things.
Jeez, I invited you on here. I just want to let you know that.
Yeah, no, all good. All good. Oh, these bloody scallywags, the young people.
Yeah, let's go back to that one. Eh? These fucking kids, these with their Serato and that shit. They don't understand.
What are they on about?
We'll cut that out. That's a bite that we're going to put on the socials for.
Yeah, like, great.
Peter, fucking P Money talking shit about the youngins. Oh, bro. So, like, when you got into battling, bro, what's the first kind of like when you dipped your toe in, bro, and you're like, listen, I'm just going to fucking battle this shit out?
Yeah. First one?
Yeah.
First battle, when I want to say 1997, Auckland, it was called the ITF, International Turntablist Federation. Sound like a boxing like organization. And it was Severe actually organized it. He brought this brand to New Zealand. He got the, you know, they had different, it doesn't matter. They had competitions around the world. He did the Auckland one for us. And DJ Rock Raider, rest in peace, is a legend. He came down from New York as a judge. And I already looked up to him. He was already DJ world champion and one of my greatest inspirations. So I just wanted to be there and participate. And I felt at that time like I had some skills that were up to par. So we went in that battle, man, 1997, and then I finally realized there was other people like me in the world that lived in New Zealand. There were other DJs that were doing these similar kind of tricks and stuff. Because I got to say, man, I didn't really know who was out there. I had never heard of like DJ Raw or Reese B and Sean, you know, the dudes that from Wellington that were killing it at that time. So I got to meet them and see them do their thing. And I came out all right, man. Did my battle, my first battle. I think I was somewhere like fourth place or somewhere around there. And that gave me a lot of confidence to like really, really go at it.
What do you reckon about DJs that just loop beats and they like drums and stuff. They do a lot of drums in their sets. Are you a fan of it?
How do you mean?
You know, like just, you know, they just use a lot of drums. Like they what do they call them? Beat juggle.
Beat juggles, yeah. That's my favorite thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to say that because I want to bring up Abbott from Hastings.
Oh, yeah.
You've been on record Legend. That said that, like, fuck, bro. This guy, or this dude did, was just beat juggle the whole time.
No. Okay. Incorrect. Because now we've got to get real nerdy. This is okay. Only for the DJ turntablist nerds know the difference, but there's a little technique that some people call chasing or strobing. And essentially it's like you play two copies of the same song and you play one beat slightly later than the first one. And then you just kind of crossfade back and forth between those two, and using certain songs, it can sound exciting and you know, kind of like, I don't know. It just sounds like, well, that's crazy, but it's incredibly simple to pull off once you know how to do it. It's not as complicated as other things. And at the time, I was really mad because he beat me with one of those style of tricks.
Oh.
And I thought I was like super advanced and technical. And I was like, my stuff is more difficult than his. But it was a really good lesson because the audience could care less how difficult it was for you to create whatever you're showing them. They just want to know, does it sound good?
Yeah.
Does it feel good? Does it sound good? Is it exciting? Yes. They don't care about the method that it took you to create it. And that applies to everything in creative, in the creative realm. No one cares about your process. The audience just care about the end result. So that was a lesson.
Like, that goes with everything, right? It's exactly, it's the product. And that's pretty cool, man. Because like, I mean, at that time, what were you to mean? Like what, 18 maybe? 20?
Oh, that one.
Yeah.
20? Yeah, 20? Maybe 21?
Yo, you would have been on your own. You would have been fucking getting high on your own supply at that time. You'd been like
20. Yeah, no, I was, man, my ego barely fit in the room at that time.
And then
that was a good lesson, man. It was a good night because I came into that competition as a favorite, and they have a preliminary during the day, and they have like, I think it was 12 of us, 12 DJs, everyone goes, and they rank them according to who's the best at the start of the day. So they know how to do the run of the night and put, you know, the better guy up against the bottom, you know, ranked person. And then hopefully the winner, you know, whatever. Yeah. So tournament seeding, you know, the terminology.
Gotcha, mate.
So I was the first seed. I was like by far the favorite. So I didn't even really do my best set against the Abbott. And that was another lesson because I had better routines in my bag. And I was like, nah, I'll just use this one. It's more complicated and technical and that'll take care of him. Oh no, it did not. So I went home with my tail between my legs and had to really think about my whole attitude towards these competitions and what I really wanted to achieve.
Because I mean,
so it was
how
a
many,
really good night.
How many routines do you like set up before when? Well, at that time, how many routines did you have in the bag, bro? Like you're like, yo, I pulled this out.
That's a good one. I think from memory, there's a mathematical way you could figure it out. Like if you were going to make it all the way to the final, I think you needed to have about seven routines, and then you'd cover each round and hopefully have enough gas in the tank to do the final. And if you had more, then good on you, you know, you're very organized. But I'd usually go in with like seven or eight different things, and each routine's probably like 90 seconds long. Yep. So it's not that much material, but when you realize how much time it takes to learn one of these routines, which could be weeks and months, then having nine of those in your back pocket is like a big task.
So like, speaking of like routines and stuff, so if you could fucking straight up Doc Brown it, bro, and get that DeLorean up to 88, bro, and go back to 2001, bro, when you came third equal, brother, and that routine, bro, when you had, well, who was there? There was Clever, there was Kintaro, who else was there?
Plus one. Yeah, from the UK, he ended up winning the whole thing.
Bro, like what would you have changed? Because that's the same format, right? As you have your bag.
Well, that one, the DMC competition that you're talking about in London in 2001, the format is just 1 6-minute routine. So every DJ goes up there and you have 6 minutes. So you put all your best stuff together. So mine was like a combination of probably like, I guess, four other bits that I put together into one thing. Sorry, what was the question though? The format was slightly different.
If you could change it up, like the routine, what could have you done? Like P Money now, like what could he have told P Money back in 2001? Say, oi, don't fucking do this, or oi, you should.
Don't go and drink with Mickey D, my mate from Wellington, heaps the night before. That's exactly what I would say. And I wasn't even much of a drinker then, but we drank so much and we stayed out very late, and I was quite sick. To do my performance. So I wasn't in my best health. And actually, if you watch this video, I kind of look a little gray in the face. I don't look well.
Did you think you were gonna like this is, might come off fucking bad, but did you think you were actually gonna do that well?
I had high hopes. My goal was to make top 12.
Oh fuck.
Because they had a videotape every year and they put the top 12 as 30 countries. So 30 countries participate, but only 12 make it onto this video. And the videos were like, how do I even compare it to anything today? The videos would travel around the world for a whole year. Everyone would want to watch that tape because that's the 12 best DJs in the world. So I just wanted to be on the tape, even if I was number 12, so everyone could see my routine and I would have accomplished something. So no lie, when they started, you know, everyone had done their thing and I felt like, hey, I kind of did all right. I made a couple mistakes, but it was pretty good. I was at backstage just talking to some of the other DJs from Canada and around the world and just socializing. And they were reading out like third place, second place, and they read out my name. And I was oblivious. I wasn't paying any attention. Like the guys I was talking to was like, yo, they just said your name. You need to go out there. So I walked out onto stage to receive my prize and I was totally stunned because I still didn't register why they called my name. So it's like, it's crazy, man. It's like getting the bronze medal and you kind of don't realize why. You're like, what are you doing? Oh, I have this prize now. Oh, thanks. Oh, wow. And here's DJ Cash Money from Philadelphia, who I stole my name from. And he's presenting me with the award. And I shake his hand like, oh my God, I'm meeting like my idol and I'm getting a prize. And what just happened? It was a blur. It was crazy.
Because I mean, like, that kind of, I don't want to say launch pad you, but that like, that really did like set off a whole series of events that kind of led to who you are, right? Like now, would you agree?
Yeah, definitely. That was probably the first big news event or big achievement that I had under my belt that I could end up doing a bunch. I ended up doing a lot of press type stuff. So TV shows would interview me and people would mention it in music magazines and all the types of media formats at the time. So my name went from Auckland, kind of local and hip hop scene, to I guess my first little bit of nationwide attention. And it was a big, noticeable difference. And it definitely was kind of the start of more to come.
Yeah. So like, how did that, is the skills from DJing, like, cause I mean, bro, fucking like, I know of it, but are they transferable over to like making beats that you started really getting into?
Well, not specifically the like technical skills, but yes, absolutely. The experience from DJing to an audience is absolutely valuable and transferable to working in the studio with artists and producing songs. And I say that because when you are out DJing regularly to an audience, you have the perfect view and vantage point to find out what people like, what makes people move, what people respond to, you know, different moods and energy and how things react with a crowd. So you do that for hours and weeks and months and years, and you amass all this information that you can then draw on when you're in the studio finishing a record. And you know, if the artist's intention is to make something for the peak moment in the dance floor, then you know what elements should be there to get that result, and vice versa. If they want to do something, I don't know, something more left field that's going to play in a certain environment, if you've been in that environment and you've played music, you'll know what works in that environment. So you're like, oh, this is how you want to tailor it. So I took a lot of that experience, and I still do. I lean on that and recall, you know, it's always there. It's always informing the decisions in the studio.
Because I think like, because you started making beats, were you making beats as well as battling and stuff like that at the same time, correct?
Yeah. It was all evolving at the same time, but the DJ stuff was more visible, you know, because I'm out there in the public.
Did you ever get like some of that, like, I know these days they call it like that imposter syndrome, but in terms of like your own beats and you're like, you know what, man, I'm just doing this for fun. I'm not trying to fucking sell this shit. But like, did you ever like feel that, or was that not even a thing?
Yeah, I was definitely looking for approval as a young producer, beat maker, trying to do things. I was like, oh, I hope people like what I make. And the whole economy of selling beats in that marketplace didn't really exist when I started. There was no such thing that I knew of like selling a beat. I was just making stuff, and then I'd play it to people who I respect. Like DLT was a good guy that would listen to my tapes, and
he's a legend too. He's the man.
Oh man, talk to him on here. But
okay, I'll get him.
So the imposter thing, I guess, to some degree. And it wasn't until I would play beats to people like Shay Fu, for example, and then he's like, "Yo, I really like this. Can I use this?" And then I was like, "Oh, these beats and things I make could be songs."
Yeah.
And he kind of sparked a kind of idea, I guess, for me to like really try and track down rappers locally and record songs.
Tell us the effect that Shay Fu had in terms of putting you on, in terms of putting you in front of the right people. Because that's what I know that I've heard.
Yeah. With Shay, see this connection, you mentioned the True School hip hop show.
Yeah.
That was like the focal point that I saw for hip hop in, especially in Auckland, if not the whole country. So I made it my business to meet the guys that do the show, not just listen. So meeting Daryl was like the biggest, like DLT was the biggest kind of plug. And then Severe after that was the next biggest plug. So Daryl would like, it's a long way to the story, but I think it's worthwhile for the viewers. Daryl would invite me to the studio when he was making his second album. No, was the first album, True School album. Yeah, his first album. And when he was working on ideas for those tracks around the same time as they made Chains. So I was already friends with him before they made Chains, or at least not friends, but it was, I knew him and he knew me enough to like come through. So then I wasn't in the studio for Chains or any of that at all. Hadn't met Shay yet, but I knew DLT. And then fast forward a bit of time when they did actually release Chains, before it had hit number one, it had just come out and they were doing the promo run for it. I went through to Hunter's Plaza, Papa Toy, they had a Sounds music store and they did an in-store performance of that song.
I remember that store, bro. That was right next to the fucking escalators, right?
It might have been, bro. Your memory better than mine. Bro. But it was in that mall and I went there just to link with them and like show support and just be there. And I'm still like kind of a kid at this point. I guess I'm 18. Teenager, just out of high school. And I met Shay through that night. Oh. And then, you know, so we got to talking and I think Shay then might've saw me later on, not long after that at something at the power station. There was like a talent hip hop show. And I had this random group that was put together of like four dudes and I was the DJ. And he saw me DJ and cut and scratch and do this stuff. And so he was like, oh yeah. Cause he's a big fan of scratching and DJs. So we had kind of connected. And then, man, I'm giving the real long version of this.
It's all right, bro. We got time.
So I've kind of connected there, but it was no talk of like, let's do music or whatever. I think it was just like, oh, he was like, who's this dude? And I was like, wow, that's Shay Fu. He's amazing. And I've listened to him since Super Groove. And he was like superstar in my eyes. So I was always really nervous when I was around these guys, but I would do my best to try and be in those circles wherever I could. And then fast forward 1998, that battle, no, 1999, ITF battle. I won that one. That was the second battle that I ever... No, that's the first battle I ever won, I think. Second battle I won. I forget, man. My memory's terrible. But I won the battle, and then Shay was there. And he's like, that was me, and congrats. And then Manuel Bundy called me up, and I knew Manuel was the DJ for Token Village, which was Shay's band at the time, or his whole crew. And Manuel said, hey, I can't do these next few tour dates with Shay. Would you be available to do it? And to me, that was like the doors to my career had opened, and Manuel Bundy had just put it on a plate. Like, if you take this opportunity, see what happens. And I was like, bro, yes, Shay's like my favorite artist. I would love to do that. And he's like, cool. Well, practice is at this time, at this location, just be there and Shay will tell you the rest. So I went to practice and I was basically down with the band within the first practice. Like I just kept turning up. I'd always be early to practice and stay till the end and just rehearse and learn all my parts and do everything he told me to do. And I basically got down with the band and then the band had a new name. It was called The Crates. So I was in that first lineup of The Crates, Shay Fu and The Crates.
Oh, man. Bro, that's crazy.
Kind of it was a bit of time. It was probably like over the course of 2 years or so of getting familiar. And then Shay put me down with the band and gave me that opportunity to, man, it was like looking at the music industry from inside, but without all the pressure of being an artist or anything. All I had to do was use my turntables and do the parts that he wanted me to do, which was really easy for me. Yeah, it was wicked, man. It was such a great time.
Yeah, I think like, cause I got Shay on Wednesday, and bro, I'm gonna fanboy out. Yo, to be specific, was like the jam, yo. Like when I was an intermediate, that was all I listened to. That and Mace Harlem World,
and crazy combo, man.
Bro, I know, but like I used to just like rock out to that stuff, and then bro, so yeah, I've gotta fucking get over that shit. Okay.
No, Shay's great. He's the nicest guy. And yeah, he really, really did show me the ropes, taught me so much behind the scenes stuff. I must have been super annoying when I think back, but I was always asking hella questions about the industry and just everything. I just soaked up as much knowledge as I could hanging around with him. And yeah, he really put me in a position. Like he put me in the videos, you know, gave me little spots in the videos, like fadeaway video I'm in there. And those things actually meant a lot back then because a video would be on national TV, you know, still had chart shows and stuff. So you get some screen time, you start to become known. And it was, it was really valuable.
Was that like, was all that information that you soaked up like helpful in terms of when you started up Dirty Record?
Yeah.
Like that would have been like, I'm just thinking about it. Like I'm kind of piecing everything together and I'm guessing like, man, all that shit that you would have, because Shay would put you on, like he's like, I'm guessing he would have been, because I interviewed Donnie and Donnie said the same thing. He was like, bro, he just drops gems of knowledge, like, and you just have to pick him up and run with them. And then I look at that and then I think what you did with Dirty and I was like, fuck, man, like, I can kind of see how it all played out. How did Dirty start for you?
Wow. So I guess it was about close to a year after, excuse me, about a year after the Shifu album, The Navigator, came out. Like within that time frame, I was making a lot of beats. I was working on the radio show that I was doing, the True School. By then, I was hosting that show that I talked about previously. I became the main host of the show, and we'd have a lot of MCs come up on the show. So I knew all the local rappers, and anyway, I just was like, there's so much talent. And I felt like, in a way, that show and myself were somewhere like the hub of a lot of that. You know, it'd be, you'd come to the radio to kind of, like, Decepticon's first interview of appearance was on our show. So there's like Savage and Miracle and Alphorus, Devolo, you know, people would just come there. So it was like a perfect way to meet everyone. And occasionally after, if we were getting along, I'd go in the B studio and play some beats and be like, what do you think? And they want to take some beats home and write raps to it. I'm sure we'll get to the Scribe story, but I did one trip out of town and met him and would send him beats, you know, post things in the mail. Wasn't even emailing beats back then.
Fuck.
Because I didn't have a computer at home with the internet. So I'd send the CDs down. Anyway, I'm totally losing track of my story, but...
Keep going, you're doing well.
But yeah, it was this demo stage of making songs that, like, even Four Corners, they're from Hamilton, another rap group that I was really, really close with. They would come up to Auckland. And so then one time I was like, well, I know a friend who has a studio. My old friend from school, will go to his place and ask for some time. He gave us some time. We recorded with Four Corners and did a song called The Whole Truth. And because I'm at BFM doing the radio show, I could take it to the station manager and say, hey, can you play this like on the radio? Fuck. And he's like, well, we'll give it a chance. And then they play it and then the phones light up and we get support for the song. So then the song becomes a number one on a BFM chart, which is very encouraging. And then we're like number one there for like a month. And everyone's talking about, oh, you need to do another song. So then I reach out to another person. And so we got all these demos. I'm like, well, now I feel like I've learned what it is for, like, from being in the band with Shay and him putting out that album and doing some beats on that album, kind of seen the process, but I know I don't want to be in that system. And I'm not the artist, so I don't think I could even get a real record deal. So I need to DIY this thing. So I need to find other people that are doing DIY music. And all I could see was, in the only people I saw locally doing it that were accessible to me was these house and techno guys over in Kingsland. And they had this thing called Cog Transmissions, which was a small record label and a couple of studios. And all the electronic dudes of the time would be making house music and techno and drum and bass. And I just rocked up there. One time I had a meeting with them. I was like, I want to do what you guys do, but I want to do hip hop. And they were like, what is this hip hop you speak of? You know, it was a pretty funny reaction. They were super nice guys and still a lot of them friends to this day. But I think there was confusion about, like, well, they don't know anything. They didn't know about rap and how to market it or how to even make it. I said, don't worry, I know it all. Just give me the chance to do it. And they flippin' did, man. Like, credit to them. They opened up the studio to me and said, just come through. And I slowly started bringing, like, Shay came and did some bars. And then, you know, Decons came through, did some bars. And then Four Corners. And we just compiled all these songs. And then next thing you know, I'm like, hey, guys, I've got the whole album done. And they're like, oh, okay. And I was like, can we put it out? And they're like, yeah, we have this distribution deal. It goes through Universal. Let's master the album. You just have to make the cover. That's another story. Ended up using a photo, blah, blah, blah. Made the cover art. And then they put it on a sales sheet. Back in those days, it was real shops, music shops. So they put it on a sales sheet. And the guy goes to each shop and says, how many of these you want to order? And the shops knew who I was. And they saw the guest lineup. And it had like Shifu and all these names on it. So they started to do the pre-orders. And that's got it started. Man, yep.
And that was big things?
And that was the beginning of Dirty Records. That was Big Things, the album.
Yeah. Wow, man.
The first album was what started the label, because it really wasn't, the idea wasn't to start a label. The idea was just, I want to put out a compilation album with all my friends. And then hopefully that will work. And then I'll do albums for each of my friends that are on the album. That was the idea.
Was Scribe 2001 the first time that Scribe got on, like, at anything?
No, he had featured on, I believe it was a Pacific Underground compilation out of Christchurch, and they had a song, the name escapes me, he'd rapped on there. And he definitely recorded stuff with Ali in Christchurch.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember if they had put anything out, or I don't think they had sent anything out. Maybe they had played stuff on RDU in Christchurch because they had their radio show down there. But yes, Nationwide, like a single with a video, Scribe 2001 was the debut.
Or what was the first time, like you saw Scribe and you were just like, fuck, this dude's kind of got it, eh? Like, could you remember back to that time?
Yep.
When was that, bro? Yep.
That was in Dunedin. I want to say 99. And it was my first trip to the South Island. We did a Christchurch show and then a Dunedin show. And in Christchurch show, I didn't really pay attention to what was going on. He was on the mic and I was doing something. You know, I was just a noisy club and I wasn't watching the stage because I didn't expect to see some amazing MC. It was just like, oh, he's hosting. Cool. Hosting's no big deal. Everyone can be a host. But the next night, we drove, because we drive from Christchurch to Dunedin. It's quite far. It's like 4 or 5 hours. And Severe was with me and he's like, bro, did you see this dude rap last night? And I was like, nah, I wasn't really. I was doing something else. And he's like, you need to watch him. I was like, okay. So then in Dunedin, I watched him and I was floored.
Uh-oh.
I could not believe what I was seeing. Just the voice, the timing, his energy on stage. He was like that superstar version of Scribe that everyone got to know. He was that already in his hometown, like in his region of that lower part of the South Island. He just was the man.
Platform, right?
He was already the man. And it was just like, whoa. And I told him on the drive back, I was like, bro, if... Well, actually, it wasn't on that trip, but I just remember saying, look, let's do something. Are you recording? He's like, yeah, I'm working with Ali. I was like, cool. Well, if you ever have time to do something else or want to work with me, like, I'm keen. And then eventually we got it together.
Yo, because, man, even on Scribe 2001, you kind of listen and you just think, like, some of these lyrics, some of these bars he's putting together, and I do remember the first time I heard that, and I was just like, fuck, like, I was impressed. And then I didn't even know it was a New Zealand rapper. I was like, oh, shit, it's a New Zealand rapper, because we're from South Auckland. All we know is Mareka. Like,
yeah,
that's all I knew. I knew Mareka, I knew you, and I knew who else did it, and like Savage and the Decon boys, and then that was it. Oh, and the Dawn Raid. Yeah, I mean, I can't say for that, but most of the Dawn Raid,
Dawn Raid was big and making noise at the same time. Yeah. They were a little ahead of us as far as putting stuff out, probably by about a year or so with their compilation, the first Southside Story.
Yeah.
So everyone that was on that, you know, those were like, that's who you would know if you're in South Auckland. But to be honest, the whole country didn't know. I felt like it was like you've discovered gold or something in some area. And it's like, bro, you are the man. But he knew he was the man. Like, as far as the MC, because he knew who was the local competition. He had his ears open. He was checking the hip-hop scene. Like, we were all very active members of local hip-hop, so we knew what was up. But, man, he was head and shoulders above everyone. And I think anyone from that time frame will tell you, like, that he was so far ahead of everyone at that time. Yeah, like, it was no competition.
All right, by far, on Big Things, my favorite fucking track is Fresh Maker G. Fuck those cuts, man. G, and I'm just like,
funny.
Fuck. This is like, I used to just like, and then Scribble come in like, 1, 2, 1, and I'm like, oh shit. That was, I would always skip to that first.
Crazy. Fuck,
we had fucking CDs. And then you'd skip to that one. Fuck, yeah. Where's that sample from, bro?
Oh, wow. It's from this really random, like a Broadway, I think it's a Broadway show or a play called, I'm going to snitch on myself. It's called Free as Air. And there's a certain recording of this play called Free as Air. And there's a part in there, and this lady's talking about, I can't remember what the context is, but she says those words like, what's the bomb bomb and all this. It was so goofy and funny, but I just was like, that would be cool if you made a beat out of it. And then I made a beat out of it, and then he heard it and was like, yeah, I've got something for this. Just 1, 2, 1, 2. And I was like, oh, this is crazy. And we just record it, and it was super like just hip-hop like skills type song. It was, nowadays I don't think people would even do a song like that. It might be considered corny, but it was like, you just rap real dope and I'll scratch real dope and we'll make a crazy beat out of a unexpecting sample, and that'll be some real hip-hop shit. And it was fun.
I remember, cool. Dizzy Rascal had like a fucking similar one. And I was like, this is whack. Nah, like, P Money killed this motherfucker compared to the old, wow. You know, because they used to do Dizzy. That. Yeah.
Dizzy, that's bro, crazy. Fuck. Dizzy, shout met, out to Dizzy, though. He's a legend. Huh?
Have you met him before?
Yeah. Yeah, I have. Very briefly. I think him and Scribe spent a little more time together conversing and chatting. But I met him, like, got the introduction, but I can't say I know the guy, but I really respect his music and everything he's accomplished.
So from Big Things, bro, then it went like the year after that was Crusader. And bro, was that like a fucking roller coaster of a fucking, like, everything going on, bro? That would have been crazy at that time, right? And you produced that whole fucking album, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, well, I think it's fair to say Scribe had a vision. He, you know, as most artists do, is like, I always want to have this vision for my debut album. But he needed that person to actually be the driving force to, like, put it together, someone that he could rely on to complete all the parts that he couldn't do on his own. And so together we made that really dynamic duo kind of team. You know, he had these great song ideas, great lyrics, amazing voice, personality, the whole package. And my beats were probably some of the best that I've made at that time. And everything was just coming together at the right time. And I'd learned enough about the business of recording music and releasing music to know that we could do it properly. And also a huge shout out to my business partner, Callum August, who was one of those guys at that Cog Transmissions label who ended up sticking with me for a decade or more. And with Scribe and you know, so the three of us really is what made that thing happen. And we had other, of course, we had beats from Shan and Dunedin and beats from Ali in Christchurch to flesh out the album and make some of the great tracks on there. But yeah, it was me and the engineer Chris Chetlin was recording it, and then Scribe would come through, lay down these verses and these ideas for songs, and then I would just add my touches and suggestions and kind of craft it into a thing. And I probably spent, I want to say, about 3 months on it, three and a bit months on just like fine tuning stuff. And Scribe's rap, some of them he'd had him in his book for like a year or so, and you know, you just keep writing rhymes, and he was able to pick the best of all his best songs and turn those into the album. And yeah, man, it was, once that thing came out, it was no turning back. Life was completely different for both of us forever.
Because I mean, like, I can't really think back, like, from, I suppose, like, mainstream kind of took it on, like, you know, like a the hip hop these days, I'm fucking, yo, I love me some Sweater and some Avondale and all that stuff, but they don't really get a lot of like mainstream love. But
yeah, that's fair to say.
Do you think like Scribe kind of like opened the door up for other dudes? Like, this is what I mean, fuck, bro, you know better than me. But I reckon, bro, after Crusader, then fucking Savage started getting on, and then D-Dot started getting on, and then like people were accepting, like, yo, because I hate to be like people didn't really like hip hop as much as we did until fucking after Crusader drops, and then all of a sudden everybody's a fucking, oh yeah, bro, I've loved hip hop for a long time. You know, did you feel that or no?
Yeah, and we welcomed everybody on board. You know, all the new arrivals. You don't have to ask us. Scribe will tell you too. We still, when we went to number one, and we know we're having sold out crowds and thousands of people coming to see us, we still remember playing some of those same songs 18 months prior to a crowd of like 10 people. Like, things happened really, really fast, man. So we still knew the feeling of like turning up for a show and like, oh, guess tonight is just practice. There's no one here, you know? And then for that to all change so swiftly was amazing. But the point you were kind of touching on, It was like this wave, right? This wave was building up, and then the wave, like, it breaks and then it rushes the shore. And at that point, Scribe was like the break, and then everything else followed and kind of came in with it. And it was wicked. So, you know, we'd kind of collectively been able to create this momentum, and that's like from Shefu, King Kapisi to Dawn Raid and Dirty coming at the same time, and then just Scribe being the one to just like, boom, he just kicked that. I'm trying to find some other analogies.
That's a great analogy.
You know, he brought it all in. So everything just rushed in. And so there was this big opening. And then you had some other newcomers that would hit the charts that you'd never heard of them even 6 months before. But now they're like they're in the top 10 as well. So you had groups that had been around for ages, like Day Hummel. You know, he'd been rapping for at least 10 years by the time he got to his number one spot. So that was well overdue.
True. Fucking forgot, you know, about him.
But he kind of rebranded as Day Hummel and came back with a new sound to go to number one. But you know, he came in, yeah, you had all these different groups. And then because you had a top tier, then it actually left more room and encouragement for the underground tier. So then you had like Breaking Records and PNC came out of there, and different other groups around the country popping up, different movements. So it was a really special time. And I count that from a probably, yeah, the wave sort of building up 2001, 2002, breaking massive in 2003. And sad to say, by end of 2006, it kind of felt like it had dried up a little bit. So it was a really, it felt like a huge amount of time, but when I look back, it was a pretty small window of commercial mainstream success, acceptance, popularity for local hip hop. And we certainly dominated for a couple of years in the charts. You know, Savage killing it. He had a bunch of number ones. Nija Mysticwood having number ones through all of that time as well. You know, they weren't classed as like strictly hip hop, but they were still part of the fam and part of the culture. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was a beautiful time for local music, hip hop specifically. Yeah.
Because during like that wave, I suppose, the year after Crusader drops, because once Crusader dropped, everything kind of, like what you said, it just, the crash of the wave was great, especially for hip-hop fans, especially for South Auckland. I think for South Auckland more than anything, because, you know, especially for kids in South Auckland, because, bro, I'm from Rewa, and everyone's like, yo, you should, like, yo, John Walker is our hero. And I'm like, nah, G, John Walker. I'm like, Marika's from Shifnal, G. Like, yep. Straight up. Like, he was in my class, and I've told this, he was in my class at JC for like a month. And then then he got expelled. And then I didn't see him again. And then, like, I had his brother, I had Ray on the other, last week, and Ray was saying the same thing. He's like, yeah, bro. Let's not talk about that. I was like, okay. But yeah, like, but like Mariko for me was like, oh shit, this dude was at my school, yo. And then he went to Papakura with Frisk and all that. And I was like, oh shit. And then when they got on, because you produced some of their stuff, right? At the
I did the song Fallen Angels on their debut album. And they also did a song on Big Things. And I remember picking up Frisk from high school, drove out back to Papakura. The studio was in the city, drove all the way back out, picked him up. He was still in his school uniform. And he's like, and he was probably the same size he is now as an adult. Like, he was a really large kid. And I'm like, how are you fitting in my car? Like, in your school uniform? This is bizarre. I thought he was already an adult, but I didn't really realize that he was so young. But that was amazing, you know, working with all those guys. And Deacons, they were massive. Mariko was a big deal, man. And he achieved some amazing stuff in his own right, like going out to New York and recording with, like, he recorded Wu-Tang Clan, man, with Spectre Deck. Like, that's amazing.
Oh, man. Who's some slipped on artists, bro, back in those days that you're like, fuck, bro, if they got bars, man, like a miracle, like, you know, like, it just kind of didn't get a break, you know?
I would have loved to see Four Corners, like, the timing of when they dropped their first actual album was probably a little bit late. Now in hindsight, they could have been a part of that big commercial wave, but the record, by the time they got it together, it was like the excitement and New Zealand hip hop being a new thing had died off, and there was a little less mainstream interest, and they started, I don't know, just playing Panic at the Disco and shit like that. But yeah, Four Corners, I think if the timing had worked out different for them, they could have made a lot more noise, because they were really a lot of people's favorites off the Big Things album, and I did a lot more work with them. You know, that didn't most of the stuff we did came out, but just the timing of it is all. Yeah, just the timing of it. So probably them, like as far as my favorite guys of my generation. Yeah, like Korma is still like one of the illest. He's so good, man.
Yeah, I've got in the chat, bro, we just got most slipped on artists. We've got Mariko, Four Corners, Cyphonetic, bro. I was a big fan of Cyphonetic.
Well, he did a lot, man. He did a lot, you know, with Breaking Wreck was his thing. That was his crew, his kind of label. You know, he did put out albums and mixtapes. So yeah, he definitely got out there. Didn't break through, but I don't know the guy. But I don't think he was ever aiming for commercial. I don't think he wanted to be doing what we were doing. Yeah. I'm sure he would have liked a little bit more of the some of the success, but you know, you choose your path.
Yeah. I think the other one is old Uncle Tynes. Uncle Tynes, old Tyner.
Tyner. Yeah, he's kind of, yeah. See, they got an album out too. They're Dubious Brothers that came out. Tyner is so talented. I love his verse on Stronger on the Crusader. I played that song again recently for the first time in quite a while.
That's it.
Go back to that, man. That verse is crazy. So good.
Oh, bro. Fuck, you're bringing back some memories, G. Let's move on to Magic City, my bro. I love Magic City. I fucking love Magic City. First question, where was that fish and chip shop that you took that photo in front of?
That is the 2J's. That's straight across the road from the old roadhouse that we were speaking
fucking
about.
Fucking knew it. See, that's it. It all connects up.
That was very deliberate. That was very purposeful.
See, like from a hood, dude. I knew that was because I saw that bike rack and I was like, that's across the road from Roadies. And then, So, fuck what up. For like a South Aucklander and to see, because like those types of food bars, you're like, fuck, man. Like, but I always remember seeing my first time seeing that and going, because there's one very similar in Rewa on, and I was like, fuck, is it the same one in Rewa? And then it wasn't. So I was like, oh yeah, I thought so.
Well, of course it had to be the one from Papakura because that's where I'm from. But, you know, I knew from my travels that kind of everybody's hood has one, you know, at least one, like it's very similar design. Yep. It's a very, you know, it's a very unique kind of fast food takeaway setup that we have all across the whole country. And it's unique to us, but I hadn't seen it repped, you know, in that kind of way. So I thought that seems perfect for me to put on the cover. I don't know. I just always thought I'm going to put that on the cover. And there's been iterations of that since then. I've seen other artists do illustrated versions of the similar thing or whatever. And it's cool. Like, cause that's just us. It's almost like putting a dairy on your cover or something. I think Swidit did something similar with like a dairy / bottle shop for one of the EPs, and it's cool, man. It just kind of ties it back to where the music's from, where the artist's from, and yeah, that's important to do, I think, in your visuals.
I think Magic City was the last album that I brought on CD. I'm thinking back, it probably was.
Wow, the end of an era.
Yeah, because then it was then the bro, fuck, my mate got one of the mini discs jump offs.
Oh, shit.
In his car, right. Bro. In his car. And then we were like, fuck, that's mini all disc. We'd get on that Napster. We'd get our shit off there. We'd put it on the old fucking, on the mini disc. And that was us. That was the jam back in the day.
That was a short-lived format, fuck, but it was actually really good quality.
Yeah. The best thing, and this is my favorite thing. Oh, I've got a few favorite things about Magic City, bro. But that fucking, when 3-2-1 starts, bro, I always remember the fucking, that's for me, that's top five start of an album. Like that fucking, bro, fuck. When you produce that, were you just like, fuck, this is it, bro. This is what we're starting with, this shit straight off the bat.
Well, I didn't know the order of what the album was going to be, but I just love the intro because it's you know, Welcome to the Terror Dome, Public Enemy. I'm like a hugest Public Enemy fan. So go back and listen to that and you'll see, cool. So I kind of was taking my inspiration from there, but I wanted to make it a modern version or a 2004 version. So I just took that beat up and actually took it with me I did a little recording trip to America and I went, because Magic City was like, I'm going to get all these American rappers on this album and the locals and mix it up. And I went and managed to get a session with a guy, Skills, Mad Skills. And he picked that beat from the CD with like all these other beats. And then he put that chorus on it. And so there's a version with just him doing the song. And then once I got home, I was like, man, this is definitely like the jump off, like the way to open the album, and definitely I wanted to make it a video, but then I was like, oh, I need to make it localized. Cause when I was in America recording all the American artists, it all made sense. And once I brought all the music home, I was like, oh, but I've kind of, it doesn't relate back to home. So I've got to make this work. So then that's why the video version is, PNC and Consta, AKA David Dallas.
Yeah.
And then Skills Verse is on there, but he's not in the video cause he was still in Philadelphia or wherever he was at the time. Yeah, man. Yeah, but thanks. I really like that track. It's one of my favorite beats.